Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. It is springtime and the high holidays, they're just around the corner. Passover happened on Saturday, Easter on Sunday. And whether you're preparing a Seder table or an Easter brunch, there's no question that special holiday meals can bring us all together. That's why we called our friend, Smitten Kitchen creator and cookbook author Deb Perlman, to share some of her favorite holiday recipes. Hi, Deb.
Hi.
So I'm curious about Seder. What has to be served in a traditional Seder? And then we'll go on to what you want to serve.
How long do you have? The Seder meal is traditionally built around the Seder plate. And the Seder plate, depending on who makes it and what you put on it, but it's five or six items. And it's actually kind of fun for kids because each of these items has a symbolism in the story. And it's supposed to tell the story of Passover through the Seder plate. So you kind of, the meal is built around these pieces, you know, from bitterness and sadness to birth and regrowth and, like, you know, the future. So that's the simplest way to put it. Everything else is really just born of tradition and practice.
Let's talk brisket. You have a tangy spiced brisket. So tangy spiced brisket, what do you do to give it a little extra zip?
You know, a little vinegar. There's, like, I really feel like, and this is, I mean, there's a lot, this is true of short ribs and a few other meats, but it really goes well with a little bit of sweetness and a little bit of acidity. You don't really want it to be more sweet than it's savory, but that's what that recipe does really well. And it's just a really easy win. And I have done many variants over it with the years with, like, different kinds of sweeter ingredients and different kinds of more acidic ingredients and savory things. But it's just, in general, if you give it enough time, and you are, you know, you season it well, you really can't make a bad brisket. I mean, I try. I feel like some people would normally call and be like, oh no, I've had some bad brisket, but I think there's usually just bad brisket recipes.
You mentioned time. Are you pro slow cooker?
I love using the slow cooker, although in modern parlance, one can use an Instapot, and it actually gets done even faster. But you can really use either. It takes well to that. Although sometimes when you have, let's just say what I'm dealing with for my Seder, where I have so much brisket that it would probably take two Instapots worth full. I might be easier for me to just throw it in the oven for 3 to 4 hours and just kind of get on with my afternoon.
What is the difference? Is there a temperature difference if you do oven versus Instapot? Can you make it? Is the temperature higher in the Instapot?
So the Instapot actually does have slow cooker functions, but most people are talking about the pressure cooking functions, which is a complex thing, which I am never going to explain properly. But it basically uses high pressure to cook things much faster, and it's wonderful for, like, tough meats and dried beans, or if you're making stock from bones. It does these things that used to take hours in 15 minutes. Slow cookers, pressure cookers have been around for a long time, but this has just made it that much easier and safer. No scariness. Slow cooker does the opposite. It stretches it out. It cooks at a lower temperature, very steady, and instead of your brisket taking, you know, 3 to 4 hours in the oven, it would take 8 to 10, maybe even 11 hours, but it comes out tender and perfect. There's not a lot of error. You know, you've got mm-hmm. this wide range of time in which it's done, and of course, it's completely hands off. The oven's kind of in the middle, where it would take a few hours, but it's reliable. You can check in on it, and you know what's going on.
This section is not for the vegetarians, by the way.
Yes.
This part of this, we're going to get some other stuff, but for right now, this is for the meat eaters in the house. So,
However, one of the really fun things you can do for vegetarians at the table is all of those things that make brisket taste good. You could cook, say, chickpeas and chunks of carrots in there. And I love this idea so much. I originally got it from the food blogger Molly Ye, and it's this idea of brisket braised chickpeas. And I would love, you can use those sauces. There's nothing meaty in them to really make a very nice braise of beans. And I think that's great for vegetarians and vegans at your table.
Excellent. I like the inclusivity.
Yeah.
But I'm still going to talk about lamb chops.
Yeah, we're going to talk about lamb chops because they're, you know, delicious.
Lamb chops with pistachio. You told me it's tapenade.
Tapenade. I know. It's
a pistachio.
Term.
I mean, it's lamb is a big Easter dish, obviously. Mm-hmm. This seems to take it up a notch.
It's just, it's a really fun, the thing is, it's actually a very simple thing, because here we're going to use chops. You can just brown them in a pan. They often just need a couple minutes in the oven, or you can just finish them if they're small enough just in the pan. And about halfway through, you put on this little schmear.
Schmear,
I know, very, very technical term, of it's ground pistachios, and there's some lemon and there's some garlic. It's just so wonderful. And it's really nice complimentary flavors that go really well with the lamb. It's very easy. And it makes a very quick dish. I make it on weeknights quite often when we get good lamb.
I have a question about the schmear.
Yeah.
Is it supposed to get toasty crunchy, or is it just almost more like a marmalade textury thing?
It's a little bit between both. It's not, I mean, the nuts have a little crunch in them, but it's more of, I'm trying to think. It's a little crackly crunch, but it is soft. The chops should have a nice color on them and a little crisp to their edge.
Does it have to be pistachios if I do not like pistachios?
No. In fact, most nuts can be worked in. You know, if you really like almonds better, I mean, the pistachios have a nice green color. But no, if you like almonds, if you like walnuts, whatever you like, I always play around with that when I make recipes with nuts, you know, where I don't necessarily use the one that's called for. I use the one I can get or the one I prefer the flavor of.
My guest is Deb Perlman. She is cookbook author and creator of The Smitten Kitchen. We are talking about holiday dishes, considering we've got Passover and Easter right around the corner. All right, we had this interesting discussion about shakshuka. I'm newly in love with it.
Do you love it?
I do love it. And it was interesting because it was an older blog post of yours we dug up, and it originally said Israeli, and then you corrected it and put a line through and put Tunisian. So this is an interesting piece of history.
And this is so interesting, and this is so complex, and it can go. But it's very simple, where most of the food in Israel originally came from somewhere else, and what you have is people in Israel who have done a lot with the food to change it in different ways. But it's still pretty much everything that we can say that is called Israeli food is really has roots in the countries around it, the Middle East, North Africa. Shakshuka is a Tunisian dish. But again, when I first started the site, I didn't necessarily know
people
the
heavily
full
identify
picture.
It. People yeah. identify it. A lot of people say it's
yeah.
Israeli, but
I think it's
it's evolved. It's, how about that?
It is a Tunisian dish, but I think it's very popular in Israel. And so what happens is when a dish is very popular in one place, it tends to be known as that, but that's not necessarily where it came from. Anyway, it's a wonderful dish, and eggs are so traditional this time of year, both for Passover and for Easter. You know, you have the symbols of like birth and regrowth, and in Passover, it's a bread-free meal, so it works really well. And it's a really nice way to turn eggs into dinner and not just breakfast. It's a spicy tomato sauce. You can add other vegetables to it. And we like to sprinkle feta on it, but you don't even have to. You could also add spinach or greens to make it more of a balanced meal. If you are eating bread, it's really great with pita or grilled bread. But it works really well for both ends, and we tend to always have too many eggs around this time of year, so it's a nice way to find a hearty meal out of it.
And so for folks who don't know, we're like, what are they talking right. about? It's poached eggs with this really spicy tomato sauce, and as you said, you can sort of add and subtract. Is there some particular spice in the sauce?
There, you know, it really depends on who's making it, but there's often paprika, there's cumin, and there's definitely some heat in there. There's usually a chili pepper or two. You can add heat however you'd like. I mean, you could be using hot sauce, you could use canned chipotle, you can be flexible with it, but traditional, it's usually got some hot pepper in there.
Matzo ball soup often makes an appearance Passover.
My kitchen is full of it right now.
You're right. The single most helpful thing you can keep on hand if you wish to make your own soups and stocks is a stock bag.
This is a little bit like, hey, you didn't think of that last week. I'm sorry, it doesn't help you right now. But I love the idea of a stock bag. Next time you're having rotisserie chicken, next time you're chopping up carrots and you have the greens from the top, next time you have some leftover onion peels or whatever, throw it in a bag, put it in the freezer, and when you're making stock, it adds real complexity and flavor to it. It's really like we have this idea that stock is made from a very rigid recipe ingredient list, and that's very helpful when you're getting started to have a recipe that works. But the truth is that you can really add what you have. It's the idea of giving a second life to old ingredients, which is also a nice Easter theme.
There are two matzo ball camps.
Sonk.
There's life and light and fluffy.
And
there's
team Sonker.
Heavy sinkers. Do you have a preference?
I like them a little bit lighter, but I have respect for both sides. I can see both sides on this, but I try to make them. I usually go a little bit fluffier. And both my mother and my mother-in-law swear by adding, instead of where you would add a few tablespoons of broth or water, they use seltzer instead, which is, you know, why not? And I find it makes them very light. They're very tender. You can cut right into them. And then it's really just a matter of size. Like, do you want it to look like Katz's Deli, where it fills up all but the last half inch circumference of the bowl? Or do you want several, like, smaller ones or even mini ones you could fit on a spoon? That's really personal preference. But I go about medium size usually.
Light and fluffy. Your secret is seltzer.
Secret is seltzer.
Learn something new today on all of it. My guest is Deb Pearlman, cookbook author and creator of The Smitten Kitchen. Her latest cookbook is Smitten Kitchen Every Day, Triumph and Unfussy New Favorites. We're talking about holiday meals for this weekend. Dessert. We can't forget dessert. What are some of your favorite flourless Passover-friendly desserts?
So this is just my own personal preference, but I feel like there are so many wonderful, naturally flourless desserts in the world that I tend to focus on them more than foods where you might add matzo meal as a flour substitute. I don't love the way it tastes in dessert. So I make the usual, like the macaroons, and I have a bunch of macaroon cakes that you can make, which are really nice, where you make these thin discs of a nut-based macaroon, and then you fill it with cream or chocolate, and it makes a really nice tender cake, which doesn't require leavening. I'm thinking to make pavlovas for my first Seder, which are just, they're basically... I feel like, by the way, when I explain pavlovas, someone's like, oh, you're not from Australia, are you? In Australia, to explain a pavlova would be to explain that the sky is blue. But here, they're not as common. And it's basically like a large meringue with a sort of crispy, crumbly edge and a pillowy inside. So it's a tender. And they're usually loaded. Yeah, they're like, it's a tender, soft, large cookie. And it's egg whites and usually a little bit of some sort of starch just to keep it tender. And sugar, so it's dairy-free, it doesn't have any leavener in it, and it's usually served with some curd or whipped cream or berries or berry sauce on it, and it's such a nice, feather-light spring dessert.
There's a really great recipe, we're going to move over to Easter a little bit now, called a Swiss rice Easter tart. Those are four words I didn't think would be together.
I should be more of an expert on this, but I had read about it and I thought this sounds so great because it's a little bit of this idea of like rice pudding in a tart form. And I'm like, how could that possibly be bad? I mean, rice pudding is like a fancier dessert. And there's a lot of versions of them. I know there are Italian versions of them and there are French versions of them. This one is Swiss and I believe it has some ground almonds in it too. But it's a really lovely dessert. And not all Jewish people don't eat rice. I mean, if you're a Sephardic, you might eat rice or some kind of the rules that you're following about kidney oat. You might eat rice on Passover. But in general, it's not the most traditional food. But I think it's really lovely for Easter.
So it's like a rice pudding in a tart. Tart crust?
Yeah, it's like a tart shell, and it's baked in there, so it's set. You can slice it, but it has those flavors that, if you love rice pudding, are in there. And you can also tinker with it to add other flavors that you like.
There is an Easter brunch recipe you have called Leek, Ham, Egg, and Cheese Bake. How did you stumble upon this combo? I mean, ham and egg, yeah. And ham and egg and onion, yeah. Where did the leeks come from?
I love leeks, though. First of all, they're gorgeous. They have that softness to them. They're a mild onion, but they cook up in a way that's kind of vegetal. They add a little bit of bulk. They add some softness. And I feel like they really kind of harmonize between like the salty, fatty bacon and the salty, fatty cheese, really. So I really like it in there. But the egg bake really came from wanting to have more brunch solutions that were for people who weren't eating not just flour, but also like if you are like on some sort of low carb diet or whatever, and it really worked well. So you've got all the cream and the cheese and the ham in there, but you don't have bread. It's sort of like a bread on the side kind of thing. So it became very useful for when we had family over, when there was always somebody abstaining from bread. And it's also just really nice for a brunch table. It gets nicely bronzed on top. It looks really beautiful in an oval dish, and it's easy. It's so easy.
You do warn about, which I've never heard it called this, the weep.
The weep. So eggs are a little persnickety. And if you overbeat them, they're generally quite easy. But if they're overbaked, the water in them, and I feel like a food scientist is going to say, but the water in them kind of seeps out. And when you have a quiche or scrambled eggs that seem kind of wet, that's what's happening. You really just want to cook them until they're just done and not keep cooking them. You don't want to overcook eggs. Nothing bad happens. It's just, oh, it's a little wet here, and you don't think anything of it. But with larger quantities of eggs, it can seem a little bit wetter. I think we see it all the time, but we don't really put it together what it is. But it really is just this idea that you just don't want to overwork or overcook eggs.
So where do you stand on pasta?
You know, pasta
for Easter.
Pasta, I think, sounds wonderful. It's obviously not something you're going to eat, you know, for Jewish Passover, but I think for Easter, it's really nice. And I think baked pasta dishes are, you know, I feel like I should be saying that they're Italian, but I feel like they're so American. I feel like almost more American tables than not, I feel like, have some sort of baked pasta, a lasagna or a ziti, as sort of a big festive meal. I mean, I know lots of people have no Italian origin, and there's always a lasagna on Christmas dinner. There's always a baked ziti for like New Year's Day. And I just think it's a very American, and it's a nice time to make a really big one.
What's your recommendation? What's one that's special?
I feel like we're going to go all in, you know,
okay.
So we're
going
to do it. So I feel like you should make, like, to me, the crowning glory of lasagna is lasagna bolognese. And you start with that long hook bolognese sauce. We all have our own recipes. You maybe use Marcella Hazan, maybe use, you know, perhaps the one on my website. But there's a lot of different versions of it. But the idea of it's this long cooked meaty ragu. And instead of using ricotta, it actually uses a bechamel, which is a creamy white sauce, which I personally prefer. I don't love the texture of baked ricotta. I'm in the minority here. So I really love the creaminess of it and the way it kind of brings everything together. And of course, cheese. We would never. I mean, we're not monsters. You've got to have cheese in there.
I want to give you a shout out before I let you go that you've got a Bon Appetit column now.
Yes.
Very exciting. Congratulations.
You.
And your latest recipe, I'm going to tell you, this is something I actually went to your website. This is where Allison uses her job to help her life. Is my son loves raspberry granola bars, and I wanted to make, you know, sort of homemade ones. And I found the ones from your website, and they're a huge hit. So when I saw this is a new dish, strawberry crisp granola.
Yes, that must be the one that's coming in May. I feel like it's literally just leaving. I feel like it just came out this week, right?
Give us
a
preview.
I will be happy to. So it is a strawberry. It's a strawberry breakfast crisp. I feel like I'm going to get the language exactly. Would you believe my issue hasn't arrived yet? But I did write it.
I mean,
what I did is, and so this is just, I love doing crisps and crumbles, but for breakfast. I feel like it's kind of underused as a breakfast vehicle. And what I do is I take down the sugar and I use like a whole grain flour and more oats and, you know, add nuts and try to keep it as granola-ish and wholesome as possible while keeping the fruit fairly simple. And then we eat it for breakfast. We eat it, you know, you could put it out as a brunch spread. It's absolutely stunning. And we usually eat it with a little bit of either lightly sweetened or, you know, for maybe for the adult, unsweetened yogurt. But it's really popular. And the leftovers are like a week of breakfast for kids. It's really nice. And they feel like they're eating dessert for breakfast. But of course, you know that there's actually a lot of oats and whole grains and natural. It's all, there's olive oil in there. There's natural sugar instead of, you know, refined sugar. So it goes really well for all of our food goals.
That's why I picked your recipe, because that's the way we get breakfast done in our house.
And this is a really quick one. I had the delight of working. I started developing some of the recipes at the Bon Appetit Test Kitchen, and it was really nice because I got to get to the feedback of, as I was making it, from the other editors. And we're like, hey, let's try it this way. And I really felt like it made it a better recipe. So it was really an enjoyable experience. And I hope that everyone else gets to enjoy it, too.
Deb Perlman's been my guest. She's cookbook author and creator of the Smitten Kitchen blog, and now also can be found at Bon Appetit. Happy holidays, Deb.
Thanks for having me. Hope you have a great holiday, too.
This is All of It on WNYC.
NYC Now delivers the most up-to-date local news from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. With 3 updates a day, listeners get breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from across New York City. By sponsoring programming like NYC Now, you'll reach our community of dedicated listeners with premium messaging and an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to get in touch and find out more.